Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 19th, 2006. Our session today is entitled, Why Can't We All Just Get Along? Our presenter is Kathy Dowd, session number DOC 2006-1. Let's listen in.
And if we have a lot of evidence to support our hypothesis, we say, I'm fairly certain that this is correct. If we have very little evidence, we could say we are less certain that this hypothesis is correct. So when you hear about in the news, oh, there's still a lot of uncertainty about global warming, there's always going to be uncertainty because we can't know this information with 100% certainty. And we can't predict the future with 100% certainty. I'll talk about this tomorrow, but the climate system is so complex that we're just getting to a good basic understanding of it. So we're never going to know this information with enough certainty to convince some of those people who need to be making the decisions about what we need to do today or tomorrow. So we deal with disproving hypotheses, and we look at our level of certainty. When we make decisions, it's because we've come to a degree of certainty that the decision makers are comfortable with. Whether it's like I'm 90% certain that this is true, or I'm 50% certain that it's true. Somebody has to decide at that point that it's enough to make a decision to go forward or not on what we want to do. Okay, the hypothesis must also be what's called falsifiable. So you have to set it up such that if it's not true, then you can disprove it. Here's an example of a hypothesis that is not falsifiable. There are elves at the North Pole, but when you go to look for them, they disappear. Okay. I can never go and find them because they're always going to disappear when I go to look for them. So that's not falsifiable, so that's not a scientific hypothesis. There are millions of people in this country that believe that there are elves at the North Pole. Most of them are less than 6 years old, but we still think of them as reasonable people quite often. So it's a hypothesis. It may be a good hypothesis, but it's not a scientific hypothesis, okay, because it's not falsifiable. All right. The other thing is that these hypotheses, they must be reasonable, they must be rationable, and they should be your simplest possible explanation, which means that you can't invoke the supernatural or you can't say it's magic. So if you want to explain why airplanes fly, you have the law of aerodynamics for that. You can't say airplanes fly because they want to. You'll never be able to prove that. I might think it's true because, you know, maybe airplanes really do want to fly. We have a spirit that wants to get into the air. That kind of makes sense in some ways. I mean, they're made up of materials that come from the earth, and if you believe that the earth has a spirit, then why can't that be transferred into these planes? Why can't they want to fly? But there's no way to study that scientifically. So I might like it as a hypothesis, but it's not a scientific hypothesis. And so I can't really study that in science. Okay, I have to be reasonable and I can't invoke the supernatural. And that is why most people would separate science and religion. Science deals with these questions, religion deals with those questions. And I think that's perfectly reasonable to do, and I'm happy to accept that. And I think that most of the public is happy to accept that, except for some religious conservatives, who I'm going to call the religionists as a way to separate them from the scientists. People who think that science is quite separate from our daily lives, and that you can't apply it to our daily lives because the Bible tells you how to live your daily life. I'll get more into that in a second. Okay. I think, though, this is also where the conflict comes between science and religion, because science says that you can't invoke supernatural explanations. But in religion, we invoke supernatural explanations all the time. Okay? And so for me, it's easy to separate. Well, science deals with this, religion deals with that. But for other people, the religionists, it's very difficult to separate. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but it worries me. I'm quite worried about where our country is heading because of that. Okay, so I'll kind of talk about that for a second and then open it up for a discussion. So for me, religion is also a way to order our experiences. But it's a different method. It's a method that's not empirical. It's a method that the ideas that come from religion can't be tested in the same way that scientific ideas can. I could say, but I don't think this is a proper use of it. Okay, if God exists, then he will strike me down right now. Just make you a little nervous if I said that. What if I really did fall over and have a heart attack? But, I mean, you can't test God's existence in that way. He's busy in Iraq. He's not going to bother with me right now. Or whatever you want to believe. So, you know, instead of looking at it that way, well, you do things like you consult the church doctrine, you interpret the Bible in your own way in order to come to an understanding of whether or not God exists, or you look at your experiences of the world and your faith, and I think those are the questions that answer for you whether or not God exists. Not testing in some scientific manner, like, okay, if God exists, he'll do this or do that, or whatever other way you might be considering that. And this is where religion and science also have conflicts, because some people have interpreted the Bible to say things like the earth is flat, that the sun revolves around the earth, and scientists were able to show that the earth was round, that the earth revolves around the sun. And so one of the first conflicts between science and religion, I think, came out of those sorts of discussions. Because science shows otherwise.
It's only a hypothesis the world is round. We haven't totally proved it.
But we have pictures of it from outer space, and it has a spherical shape.
But that could be found by looking.
Yeah, but it could be a two-dimensional thing still. Yeah. But we should talk about that. Hypothesis and theories. A hypothesis is your first start on explaining something, and then a theory is something that, when that hypothesis has been confirmed numerous times, it becomes a theory. And then some things become a law when we're, you know, like 99% certain that we have it figured out. And there are very few laws, actually very few. Okay, so when science sometimes shows that those interpretations that are made from the Bible are not exactly correct, or we're 90% certain that they're not correct, then we start this antagonism between religionists and scientists. And I think that antagonism today comes out in things like influencing our science curriculum in the schools. I think it comes out by limiting the types of scientific research that is done. And I think it comes out by dismissing some scientific results and deciding on or influencing policies because of our ideas, our beliefs, rather than what we can show in science to be true. I think that religionists see science as another belief system, which I think leads us into some trouble that I'd kind of like to hear your views on. And so what's the damage? Why should I be concerned about that? Well, I think some of the damage is also that it starts to polarize these debates and things become ideological, so that a person holds a view that is contradicted by the reality. And I think that's one of the things that leads us to bad policy decisions that disregard science. Because they have an idea of what they want to be true, and so it doesn't matter what science shows, because this is what they believe. So this is what they think we should act on or not act on. Okay, I think I'm going to end there and ask you to give me some input on this. I have one final thing that I think we could say closer to the end, but I'd like to hear what you think about this. I mean, do you see this as a problem in today's thing?
Well, I think... In addition to what you said, science is a process and is a community in a way.
Yeah.
And each specialization is a community of tight-knit people with their own vocabulary and they, their own refereed journals. And there's a process by which these hypotheses become, move from hypotheses to accepted truth. And they built this edifice of knowledge. When you get to the upper stories, you're still in this hypothesis uncertainty sort of, that you haven't got the next story completely built. But it's resting on fairly firm foundations because they've got these referee journals and tested hypotheses, and they move on to textbooks, and universities teach and discuss, and they have conferences. But there's this intersection of these communities with the popular culture, where there is this confrontation going on, and where there's actually some contrived controversy because of interests that are well-funded that are trying to enter the debate and create debate where in these communities there is none. They're trying to chip away at the lower stories that are very firm and established, and trying to undermine them through what I would call contrived doubt. And that's where there's a lot of problem, I think, because these buildings are beginning to, these multi-story structures are beginning to raise questions about how we are living our lives and that the way we live is becoming a problem. And that's where you've got serious issues. It's where science is beginning to raise questions about how we average folks ought to be living our lives. Mm-hmm. And that's, there's where there's a rub.
Seems to me that the problem isn't only with religionists, in the sense that in the 20th century, you talked about the end of the 19th century when there was this whole science academy, and people believed, I think there was a general American at least, believes that science would solve most or all problems. Mm-hmm. So yet scientists dissing religion and people of faith, saying we're finding truth through science rather than keeping separate the questions they're given. In some respect, as much as I hate to say it, it seems to me the religionist movement of the last 30 to 40 years is in some respect a reaction against scientists dismissing the relevance of the questions of people of faith we're trying to struggle with. And somehow we need to get both communities to say there's a place for both, and we need to have the interchange be a place of dialogue rather than dismissing the other point of view.
And you said the word questions, both from science and from faith, that's where they can intersect.
Yeah.
If they both agree that both have to have questions and struggle. When 9/11 hit, the people that caused that didn't like questions. Everything was nailed down and there was certitude. And they were against questions. And I think faith community and science community are best when they can ask questions together.
One thing that, I'm a public school teacher, and one thing that concerns me, we haven't even talked, the big creationism thing, which I think is a perfect example of the problem, and whether creationism belongs in the schools, and that could be a whole other discussion. But, you know, and I personally don't think it does. Okay, I think that's a matter of faith, and it tells you how God did it, but in school you learn how it was done, and in church you learn who did it. And that is a relatively simple thing for me, but it's not for a lot of people. And I think creationism in the schools and whether it belongs there is a real good example of the problems. Because there's some really religious people that think it belongs there and some really religious people that think it doesn't.
And there are problems with the scientists themselves not being very scientific. Something like the Columbia River floods, where the original hypothesis that there had been a monster flood was laughed out of existence almost. And even when it was finally proven that I was half of it, were a couple very prominent geologists still wouldn't give up, saying it couldn't have happened that way. So.
Yep, I think plate tectonics is a good example of that too, in the 60s, where people came up with that theory. You had asked the question earlier why some people don't think themselves, well, you said the common study of science. And I think what you were saying about getting so focused on it, and so many of these articles, when I try reading them, TLAs, three-letter acronyms. You go into an article, there's no definition of what these, all these abbreviations for all this stuff. And the person who's not really focused on discipline has no concept of what they're talking about. If they could put it in terms that made sense, much as if our lawyers were laws in terms that would make sense to the rest of us so we could understand, I think we'd have a lot better communication ideas and common people. A couple quick ones when I was talking. You made the comment about beliefs and this kind of thing. Technology, when it grows far enough, there's like Clark's Law. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Meaning, if it's so far advanced that you have no concept of what it means. To me, I use it all the time, but I have no concept of how Ethernet and the Internet works. I'm in science in different ways, but it's, may as well think of it as magic. And the people who can understand it, that creates a real gulf sometimes.
Who claim they understand it?
Well,
one of the problems we have with the Bible is that it was written in the Eastern world, an Eastern thought system, and we tend to make things very dogmatic and very certain to, like, particularly in the numerology area. I mean, the 7 days of creation, the 6 days of creation, that's it, 6 days. Well, you know, when Jesus said, when Peter asked, you know, should I forgive my brother seven times? He said, no, 70 times seven. Well, Jesus didn't mean 490 times, and the next time you can zap him. No, he didn't mean that. That's used as symbolic, though, and we hang up on this too much. It reminds me of, I've heard this story or not about this man talking to God, and he says, God, I understand that a million years is just like a second to you. He says, that's right. And he said, also I understand $1 million is just like a penny. He says, yes, that's right. The man said to God, can I have one of your pennies? And God says, wait a second.
You know, I once had a conversation with my very fundamentalist sister, who lives in Flagstaff, Arizona. We just returned, my wife and I, from a visit to Petrified National Monument, which is, you know, and we talked to her about these trees and how amazing it was that these 200 million year old trees were still, you know, looked like trees, you know, in the ground. And she said, oh, you don't really believe that they're 200 million years old, do you? And of course, she believed that the earth was only about 6,000 years old. And to me, the problem that a lot of people who don't believe in science and what it says about the world is that what they would then have to believe is that God is deceiving us. He gave us this rational mind and is leaving all these clues about the possibility that the earth might be really old with dinosaur fossils and all these things, the means to do carbon dating. And then it's all a trick that God created along with the earth, that he deliberately created us to be rational people with the ability to understand God's creation, and that God deliberately set out to test our faith in this Bible by creating all these clues that were absolutely wrong. And to me, that reminds me of what God, Einstein said, is that God is subtle, but God is not malicious. To me, you'd have to believe that God would have to be malicious to so trick his creatures, his intelligent creatures, by doing that, which does not seem consistent with the idea that the simplest solution is best, that indeed if that's the part of the world that God created and the world that it is good, that all of this evidence is good, is there for a reason.
Does anybody have a response to that? Like, does anyone believe or have a response to this idea that, I mean, he thinks that if God is malicious, then he has set out all this evidence to trick us. I mean, I can't believe in a God like that, but
he doesn't believe that.
He's
his fundamentalist sister.
My fundamentalist sister would have to
have that understanding
of God, that God would entrap us that way into a false understanding of God's creation.
But maybe it's not malicious. Maybe it's art.
Maybe it's what?
Art.
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 That was
kind of
nice
shapes, fossil shell shapes.
Or some other motivation. I mean, we could say, well, maybe it's a truth, or maybe we're mistaken. And then if God created everything and he set this up in a fashion that we would be mistaken, then we're projecting some emotional overlay onto that. That would be malicious. That would be funny. That would be a trick. I mean, you could project all sorts of human emotions. Who knows what the truth would be if that were the case? And malicious would be one possibility.
Okay, and art would be another.
And art would be another.
I think that fundamentally within religion, whether you are a conservative or a liberal, most of us have been raised with the notion that we have this omniscient, all-powerful, all-seeing, all-knowing God, and that nothing happens unless God deigns or designs or whatever word we want to use, that it will happen. And so, and then we take Scripture and we attempt to overlay that over what's happening in our world, and we attempt to find scientific answers for what's happening in our world out of Scripture, which Scripture was never intended to be a scientific journal, and or it's not even historically accurate in every case. And yet we want it to be, and so we read those types of things into what Scripture has to say. And I think for many people, it's terrifying to think that what we think our Bible says, it doesn't say. Or we have created words to fill that void where we don't understand or we don't know. So we just say, well, God must will it, or it must be what God wants. And science undermines that, because science can say, you know what, there are some processes in place here and things are happening that we don't fully understand. But this world is evolving, if you want to use Darwin's theory of evolution, for instance. And that scientifically is a fact. I mean, it's there. We can prove certain things. And I'm not going to get into the species issue, whether or not we came out of the sea or we evolved from apes or whatever. But there's a process in place here, because we are not the world that we were 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And religious people struggle with that because it confounds their understanding of God. Scientific people look at it and say, why would you even be religious in the first place? Because there's no room for that within science. And I think, you know, they are different animals and need to be looked at differently. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know that they do have to be separate. I think it was Hawking in that book of his, maybe he got it from someplace else. It was someplace in there he said, we're explaining the how.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna get into the why. That is beyond science. That has nothing to do with it. And if I look at my concept is that a lot of God's intervention is setting up the physical laws, the rules, the way things work. The one I just wrote down quickly is ice. When it freezes, is lighter than water. One of the rare materials that when it goes solid isn't denser, which would sink. And if that were the case, the Earth would be solid ice right now, because every time ice formed, it would have sunk and more cold. But it insulates. How or why that rule? And as far as I know, I don't know if we know the physics of why that is exactly. Maybe the physicists have gotten in there. But whatever the system was set up, that's the case. And it's allowing us to exist. And like to reform for whatever it is. Yeah. So we're finding how, we still don't know why.
Don't know why. And that's where I was headed with this, is to say that, you know, within the context of the world that we live in and our understanding of the world that we live in, if you take a strictly creationist viewpoint on things, that's quite different than a scientific viewpoint. However, I think that most scientists agree today that if you boil everything down to the probability of chance, that is irrational because it is so insignificant. You know, that everything came together the way that it did without some intent being behind it is absolutely improbable. Am I right about that, or?
There's another way to look at that, and that is that we wouldn't even be here to question what are the chances that this would happen if all of those things didn't come together in exactly that same way. So to even think about chance in some ways doesn't even make sense, because it's us who are here as we are with the ability to look back on where we were. So I guess that's where I come up with that. I mean, I think that almost doesn't matter, because we wouldn't be here if all of those things didn't happen. So for us to be looking back on, I don't really know how to explain that any better, but could you?
I don't know exactly how to put it into words, but I think that we get distracted by these arguments, and that I think that, I mean, it's very complex, but things that science has been fairly good about proving have been denied by many people for years and years. I think of the lung, when we get away from the religious beliefs and so on, we can look at it a little more objectively, I think. And that is like cigarettes causing lung cancer. I mean, that's been known for so long, and yet people denied that and said it hasn't been proven exactly, you know, and yeah, sure, we need to be skeptical, we need to look at the rest of the issues, but part of that was driven by money, by the tobacco industry. And I don't know about the evolution thing being driven in that way, but I certainly know that the global warming thing, you know, people are saying, no, you know, that doesn't exist. And a lot of that is driven by money, because we want to keep what we have and how we do it. And I think that we can get together on the religion and science thing, but it's nice to deny stuff because we don't want to face up to these terrible things.
Right. And what happens when money teams up with religion to fight these things?
Yes, and that's what I see as the danger now with what you're bringing up.
Okay. You haven't talked yet?
I'd like to go to two gentlemen. Your analogy of the stories and your comments about Middle East. I'm a linguist. and I'm very fascinated. I've done some translations, and a lot of that phrase is lost in translation. And I see Christianity as both historical and symbolic. And there's room for science in the history of processes that change. And there's room for symbolic. And there's where the fundamentals get stuck, because I live with a fundamentalist family, and they're meaning of the word in English. And as we had last week, if any of you were here last week, a kind of presentation of how when you go back to the language and able to read it in those other languages, sometimes that fundamentalist interpretation of a word is very drastically changed and a perspective. And then I did, in the past 2 years, a teaching. I had an English physician teaching reading on a Native American reservation, in which Kit Peake, the greatest scientific astronomical observatory that we as human beings have. And I took a tour of that several years ago, 20 years ago. And a Native American, they lease those sacred mountains from the Otham tribe. And our tour guide gave a very thorough tour of all the telescopes that were up there and what they were doing. And then we sat down on the side of the hill, and he said, when they discover something we don't already know, we'll listen. And that revolved, that's been revolving around my mind for over 25 years. And so when I went back to Kitt Peak 2 years ago, I was talking with one of the scientists and told him that. And he said, you know, that's true. Because every time we look at the skies, there's a, you know, a different changing perspective, although they have this wonderful story, as you said, when you get to the higher levels of this story, even though you have this foundation, perspectives can really, you know, move around. And this gentleman, you know, use of that. You said you use the Ethernet,
right.
And, and you don't know why, and it doesn't inhibit your use of it. You know something about the how. And that's what I think is getting all mixed up in these creationist arguments, these other Da Vinci Code arguments, you know. And I do think we get distracted because there's room for all of it, as there's room for Kitt Peak on top of the Sacred Mountain and the questions that have been asked for years.
Okay. What about when our ideas of this is, I don't understand this, so it's magic. What about when those ideas inhibit going forward with policy to deal with like the ecological crisis we find ourselves
in? He didn't say it was magic. He just
well,
said
but
it
you think about it as magic,
no.
Right?
It's indistinguishable.
Some people.
So, yeah, well, some people.
Not necessarily.
Right, and probably not even the majority of people. But what about when those people are able to influence the policies rather than the science influencing the policy?
It seems to me that we have, in the science world, made it kind of easy to dismiss conclusions by our use of the word theory. In the science language, that word is one definition. In the non-science or religion world or public policy world, theory means we don't know yet. And if we don't know yet, it makes it easy to continue on as is, in quotes, waiting for more proof. In the science world, you don't become a theory until you're pretty darn sure the vast majority of the construct, the foundations, are really pretty solid. And I think that's where we find ourselves in the global warming debate today.
Do you think we should change that?
I have thought for a long time that the word theory in present America is not a helpful word in the way we use it in science.
Sorry, you had your hand.
Well, I was just going to address the idea that as faith communities, I think it's a very important thing that we are always asking, are we holding so tenaciously to something because we fear our world is going to fall apart. And it's like we diminish God by thinking that we need to protect something so fiercely. And I mean, anywhere where, I guess I would like it more to be the human community working together on wholeness for everyone. And not having faith communities just being so worried about what's a sin, what's going to totally erase our concept of God. And I mean, can't we just say that we hold on to things and frankly, when we die, we'll maybe find out if they were true. And the rest is that we want the community to be good for everybody. And so it takes research, it takes, you know, trying to decide what's ethical. I think we need to be very careful as religious communities to say we think we know a lot, we know little.
Okay. How can the scientific community get what it would see as your reasonable ideas there? How could we get people in the faith community to use reasonable ideas like that and spread them around to sort of overcome.
I just think as a faith community that feels very differently than some of the politics of the religious right, that we need to speak those words and we need to speak them very clearly. Because I get embarrassed at times at what they are reacting against that hurt other people.
Would you speak out against that then when you hear it? Or you
definitely.
Okay. Did you want to say something to that?
I just had an issue with you continuing to use reasonable.
I think I know what you're doing, but that implies
a system of logic, and systems of logic have changed. So the umbrella word of reasonable, I think, is narrow.
Okay.
I think one thing that would be valuable would be for religious liberals, if that's how we want to characterize the difference between us and other.
Oh, I wouldn't use the word liberal.
Religious progressive or religious anyway. Centrist, I hope, eventually. I think we need to own the fact that science and Houston Smith once wrote in his book, The Religions of Man, something that's always been very important to me personally in understanding this issue. And that is that the Judeo-Christian tradition was a very important impetus to the to the establishment of science. It is no accident that science flourished in Christian Europe and to some extent even Muslim Arabia, which is a Semitic tradition also. And that is because the Old Testament is a story that begins with the premise that God created an ordered universe, that it is a lawful universe. It is not chaotic, that we can understand it. And that idea that there is this order is what makes science possible. This faith in order is what makes science possible. And so I think we need to own that science is not this sort of separate compartment of the human search for God. It's part of us. It's all part of us, and what we're trying to find out. And science is one tool among many for understanding what God is and who we are. And so we shouldn't be defensive about what we're learning from science. We should be proud and joyful as these mysteries get unraveled, that this is something to be greeted with joy and share. Like evangelists, like true evangelists. Gosh, isn't this great that we're learning about the planet? Isn't this great that it's teaching us that we're one community, and maybe global warming is God's gift. That maybe global warming is the threshold for us to begin to respond to one problem as one people and put all of our conflicts aside toward one goal, which is collective, loving the planet. And we're all and maybe that's we can go there. I can definitely see us turning this into a religiously transformative event in the history of the human race.
With a foot stomp.
With a foot stomp.
All of us who have had kids, when the kids are 2 and 3, the why question drives us nuts because it never stops. It seems to me that in the 21st century world we live in, our educational process drives curiosity out of most people. And building on both of your comments, if we could build into all of us that it's a gift to be human, to be curious, and science is one way of learning and to celebrate all the new stuff, and to say, God, thank you for that gift, I think we'd be healthier.
Not just science, but philosophy.
All of the disciplines. Yeah.
Well, in the case of astronomy, the church brought it on itself because its big concern back 1,000 years ago was when does Easter come? You know, it's the first full moon after the vernal equinox. And they supported astronomy just to be able to predict when that would happen in the ensuing year.
So Galileo came along and got himself in trouble.
I wanted to make a comment on something that Sandy had said about how, you know, when we begin to deny the scientific process, because of our fear of how that might diminish God, I think we diminish ourselves too. And there are a number of ways to look at ourselves, and as we consider the fact that we are, well, at least, you know, we like to use the language that we are created in God's image. You know, one of the ways that you can look at that is physical. I tend to think that's probably not what it means, but that's an option, I suppose. The other way is intellect. And that seems to me to have more promise, I think. And so we diminish ourselves, too, if we don't use that gift of intellect. And I sometimes think, and I fear to some degree, that that's part of what's going on now with the whole debate over whether or not we do stem cell research, etc. We make it an ethical issue, we make it a religious issue, one based on moral grounds, out of fear of how it could be abused without thinking about the possible benefits to people who are suffering and dying today and will in the future. And I think how tragic, you know, that God's given us this intellect. Can't we find healthy ways to use it?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for religion to step up to those questions of what is okay for scientific research. I mean, should we be using stem cells? I think that's good for religion to step up into that conversation, and everybody too. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that one group should be able to dominate that conversation. That it should be something that everyone contributes to decide whether or not we should follow those lines.
Well, that's a public
policy.
In some
ways,
it's not really a science policy. You know, it's
right, but
a
it
power
affects
issue.
Science and it affects or in it's influenced by religion. So,
yeah, but it's more a political power policy issue. It's just like I did the California literacy program years ago with all the farmers versus, you know, the pesticides and the that were in the ground. And it wasn't an issue. They all knew. It wasn't a farming issue, in other words. They all knew what the pesticides and the fertilizers and everything else. But if one of them went organic without the others, they would be putting them out of business. So it was a money issue and an economic issue, not a, should we say, a farming or a knowledge or awareness issue. And that's what I think a lot of this religion and science, it's neither a religion or a science issue. It's a, you know, money, you brought that up, the interest and a public policy issue. So there's a process by way we deal with that and how one group gets to dominant power in a certain issue and you know, another does not, and how we speak out if we're not of that persuasion. But by polarizing it, it's a distraction, as one other gentleman thinks. Because the issue is not. You know, I mean, now, in 2000, we have a whole plethora of organic farmers, because they solved the economic problem of that in California. The farming problem was way, way back in the 70s and 80s when they knew the awareness from the universities who had done research in Santa Cruz County and on up. And so that's it. You see what I'm saying? The different processes interlock, and we sometimes get confused by polarizing them, which is not, and I personally believe that's what's going on with global warming. You know, it's become an issue other than science and religion. By dominant powers.
Kathy, I hear you keeping coming back to policy based on a small group, and I think that's what, I think the vast majority of these people here probably are not the fundamentalist Christian writer, for lack of a better term, that is doing the literal things and throwing science out and that sort of thing. And so how do, I guess my question is, I find it frustrating that I think the silent majority, if you will, of people that aren't extremists, don't mobilize and don't express themselves, so that this small group, which I hope is a fringe, in terms of percentages of Christians, seems to be getting all the press and the squeaky wheel getting the grease, you know? And and I guess my question is, because especially Lutherans tending to, even in terms of not being as good evangelizers as those people and not, you know, we're not good about sharing our faith verbally, like with people we don't know. It's the same thing. How does all this wonderful discussion, what do we do when we go out of here, you know, to do something about the Gulf that you're
okay.
talking about?
I'll tell you what to do, because I'm going to tell you what to do. but my idea in having this discussion was kind of a hope that when people came to such a discussion, thinking that, you know, these are not going to be the fundamentalists who are coming to this, but people who are in more agreement with me than disagreement, would be that, you know, these are people who would be the ones to speak up in their communities, who would be sort of inspired to speak up in their communities. And one way that you can do that is learning more about what science is and how the process works and what the science is that's out there. I mean, there are wonderful scientific journals like Scientific American that are perfectly understandable to a general audience. And you don't have to understand all of the background in the science, because they're going to explain it to you in that article. And there are great books out there that explain, you know, what science is and how it works. And if you're interested in the creationism versus evolution debate, and there are wonderful books that also talk about, you know, why intelligent design is just not science and doesn't belong in our classrooms. And if we're silent, if we agree to that motto, teach us the facts and let us decide, well, there are no facts to intelligent design. There's a belief system behind it. So I'm just hopeful that people of a faith community would go out and speak up about these things rather than being a silent majority, that we stop and we read and we speak out and then we vote with those ideas in mind.
But see, you're denying the no facts. I'm not a creationist. And I would support that it's not in schools, but by the very fact of denying, it's encouraging these people to dig in and say, yes, it would, because they're searching for a place where that can be expressed.
But they're already
That's why we have 400 charter schools in Arizona, because they're using the schools. They want to train for their belief.
Right.
We're training for the Darwinist belief in the schools. See, now why are we denying them an avenue for training?
Right, but
it's a public policy issue. That's what I'm saying before. See, should they have institutions, which they've gone about and have? That's why we've got most charter schools, 400 charter schools, that are under the umbrella of public schools. They get the taxpayer money, see? So
yeah.
This is what I'm saying, like the organic farming. It's not a science and religion problem. And you can meet all the Scientific Americans in the world or try and understand, you know, the fertilizer processes and things like that in California. But what I learned from that incident in the 80s and my going around as a literacy teacher in California was that it was not a science problem. It was, an economic problem. So in order now for the organic farmers that do have an avenue, it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm saying give an avenue for these people to have their schools and teach and then see. And then open in the open. You're not denying them.
Right.
You know,
what about bringing those things into our public schools?
Pardon?
What about bringing that idea into our public schools?
That's already in there. The charter schools are in under the umbrella of public taxpayer money. So, and then they have an expression, and they'll see, you know, you'll see whether that'll survive or not. You know, it's in the open marketplace. That's where I come from. Let's see. If it's not, you know, valid in any ways or ever, those charter schools have pulled under, and some of them have. And you see, we get all mixed up in what's not really the issue, and even if we don't have that belief, deprive people from having an avenue of expression. That's what you said, gets lost sometimes in the distribution and the translation.
In the state I'm from, the conservatives, especially the fundamentalists, don't even bother with the debate. They just pull their kids out of school and teach them themselves. or they form
homeschooling
a small,
is another
or they form a small
yes.
academy,
yes.
And it, what it does is weaken the entire education system.
Not necessarily.
It does funding wise, definitely. If they go out, public schools got less money.
If they homeschool,
yes.
If they charter school, no, because they're still within the umbrella.
Okay, we
have less money but fewer students.
There's another field of science that enters in here, and that's sociology.
Yeah.
And what motivates us, what drives us as people to want to think in particular ways. And that is problematic too, I think. I mean, this stuff is attractive to a pretty wide range of people. It may not be attractive to you or me, but some people have an intuitive need, an innate need, to be surrounded by that thought process. And they are, those individuals now are training their children within that too. I had a neighbor come over to me the other day about the Da Vinci Code. And she wanted to know what I thought of it. I said, well, I've read the book. It was one of the more engaging books I've ever picked up. I said, I loved it. Once I started reading it, I couldn't put it down. I said, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And she said, so you would encourage your congregation to go to that? I said, well, of course I would. I said, I'd tell them, buy the book, read the book. But I said, not because it is biblical history.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a novel, for crying out loud. I said, it's fiction. I said to her, read it like you would read the Left Behind series. And she gasped at me. And she said, well, that's fine. Well, that is biblical. I said, oh, hogwash. I said, it is not. That's fiction. We're crying out loud. No. And she said, well, my 18-year-old son is graduating, wants to go to the show. And she said, I'm terrified. I said, why? Well, he's so impressionable. And I said, well, let him figure it out, for crying out loud. You've done your job. Let him get out in the world now and make this. But people
yes,
are terrified.
Yes,
okay, enough.
And we really do have to end. There are other things to do today. And so if you, I would encourage you to continue these discussions among yourselves at lunch, wherever you're going today.
Oh, well, thank you for opening the Pandora's box.
I would like to talk to you.